Disc 44.
Sometimes, for a new visitor, he would sweep aside the heavy drapery behind his desk there, and suddenly the window would be filled, as one reporter wrote, with the marbled city below, with its great avenues running toward the White House. Grand as this suite was, it was still too far from the chamber floor for his liking. But on the same level as the chamber floor, and conveniently near it, was a suite of two huge rooms that had been the staff and meeting rooms of the Senate's District of Columbia Committee. He commandeered that, too. On its high ceilings, above its big crystal chandelier, were frescoes, as soon as he chose the office, painters began touching them up, of boys carrying baskets of flowers and young maidens reclining on couches, a Roman emperor's banquet. Reporters began referring to it as the Emperor's Room, before coining another name which stuck, the Taj Mahal. Lady Bird imported an interior decorator from New York to redo the suite in green and gold. On entering the office, Sam Schaffer wrote, one was immediately confronted by an extremely well-lit, fully life-size portrait of its occupant, hung above its marble fireplace. The artist had portrayed Johnson leaning against a bookcase, but he had captured at least some of the piercing quality in Johnson's eyes. That huge picture of Lyndon looking squarely in the visitor's eye first thing on entering Lyndon's office is a sure irritant, John Steele reported in a memo to his editors at Time. And it was not only Lyndon Johnson's portrait that was well lit. High above the desk, concealed in the chandelier, two spotlights had been placed, focused so that as the man himself sat at the desk, they cast on him what one reporter called an impressive nimbus of golden light. In a corner of the immense room, he had ordered high walls of polished mahogany built, and behind them was a bathroom, a Johnsonian bathroom, a monument of a toilet, James Reston called it, used as Johnson used bathrooms. Soon secretaries, assistants, and senators were having to take dictation from him or discuss issues with him as he sat before them on the toilet. Johnson made other changes, too, in that Capitol wing that was his world. When he came to the deserted Capitol on a Sunday, he sometimes had to wait a minute or two for an elevator, since only one elevator operator was on duty. Now the waiting time was eliminated. Three operators were on duty all Sunday. And the operators of the subway between the Capitol and the Senate office building no longer stopped working at 6 o'clock. They remained on duty until Johnson had left the Capitol. The pattern was discernible not only in the office, but in the way visitors to it were treated. Not the committee chairman, of course, but almost all his other colleagues. Often they were kept waiting. Sometimes there would be three or four senators of the United States cooling their heels in the majority leader's antechamber. Even the placid Mansfield once lost his temper over the length of time he was kept waiting for an audience and left, saying to Ashton Ganella, "Well, I'm not going to wait this long for anybody." Mansfield's attitude displeased Miss Ganella. In recounting this incident, she told the author, "I did not like people who did not respect Mr. Johnson." While the time senators spent in the suite's outer office was sometimes uncomfortably long, the time they spent in the inner office was sometimes uncomfortably short. A request might be made of the leader, and it might be denied quickly and curtly, after which it was clear the applicant was expected to get up and leave. Lyndon Johnson's attitude toward his colleagues was increasingly proprietary and paternalistic. They were his children. It was his Senate, Ms. Ganella explains. Some of them were wayward children. That was all right. That was why he was there, the firm fair father, to see that they didn't get into trouble. In November 1958, he would tell John Steele, in an off-the-record interview, "You know, I feel sort of like a father to these boys. A father loves his sons, though one son may drink a little too much, another may neck with the girls a little too much. A good father uses a gentle but firm rein, checks his sons, guides them, and above all understands them." He knew what each of them needed. In 1958, he selected his new favorite, Frank Church, for the honor of reading George Washington's farewell address in the Senate on Washington's birthday. Telling a reporter why he had selected Church, he explained that he needed a bit of bringing forward, just like my daughter does at school. More and more, he was unguarded in his estimates of his colleagues' abilities and in his description of their relationship with him. After all, why should he watch his words? What could they do about it if they didn't like them? Now, Allen, he said about Bible, said to a journalist, Allen is a good mediocre senator. He'll do what I tell him. He let reporters know how cleverly he manipulated them. His attitude was also apparent in the terms in which he described his own activities. In January 1958, 2 days before the President's State of the Union address to Congress, Johnson delivered a speech to the Senate Democratic Caucus, instructing George Reedy to tell reporters it was Johnson's State of the Union address. Did a president have a cabinet? During the course of his speech, Johnson, as Time put it in a March 1958 cover story on him, hoisted himself to political heights without precedent by referring to himself, in effect, as President of the U.S., South Pennsylvania Avenue Division. As majority leader of the Senate, said he, I am aided by a cabinet made up of committee chairmen. Doris Fleeson might poke fun at his pronouncements, asking if he had worked out a disability agreement with his second-in-command, Mansfield. But most of the Washington press corps, which had overplayed each attack on Johnson's leadership, and then, after each one had failed, had conceded that his power was greater than ever, agreed with Time's assessment that Johnson is, without rival, the dominant face of the Democratic 85th Congress. As such, he does indeed stand second in power only to the President of the U.S. Asking, who is the most powerful man in the United States today? Stuart Alsop, in January 1959, answered his own question. The President. But, he added, Senator Lyndon Baines Johnson certainly runs the President a close second, especially now that voters have given him a huge majority to lead. There are those who argue that Johnson is, in fact, if not in theory, the country's most powerful man, because he loves to exercise power, and President Eisenhower does not. But although during the final 3 years of his Senate career, Lyndon Johnson's power over the Senate was as great as ever, the legislative achievements of this last stage of his Senate career were in many ways no more than a reprise of his early years in the Senate. This late period opened with a repeat of the theme, preparedness, that had been so prominent during the early period, more full-throated but in most aspects remarkably similar to its earlier form. On October 4, 1957, during the Senate recess before the opening of the Senate's 1958 session, Russia launched Sputnik, traveling companion, the first man-made satellite to orbit the Earth. Americans were shocked, having been confident of their nation's technological and scientific superiority over the Soviet Union. A new age, the space age, had been launched, and it wasn't America that had launched it, but America's most feared enemy. Despite the Eisenhower administration's attempts to minimize the Soviet Union's achievement, Sherman Adams said that America was not about to play the Russians in an outer space basketball game. In the first excitement, its implications seemed ominous. The Russians had beaten America in the race to develop a missile capable of placing a satellite in orbit. Might they not also win in the race to develop a missile capable of delivering nuclear warheads? Lyndon Johnson was down on his ranch when the news came over the television late that afternoon. He was to recall that when, after dinner, he, Lady Bird, and their guests, Dale and Scooter Miller, took the evening walk on the dirt road next to the Pernalis, they peered up at the dark hill country sky, unsuccessfully straining to catch a glimpse of that alien object among the sky full of stars. He felt, he was to recall, uneasy and apprehensive, as did much of America that night and in the weeks to come. The country's first reaction was an alarm that approached panic. In the excitement, it seemed that the administration had squandered America's lead in missilery, and that the nation had been caught unprepared as it had been 7 years earlier when communist troops in Korea had attacked without warning across the 38th parallel. With the nation possibly in danger, Richard Russell was again not the bigot, but the patriot. A patriot who, in love of his country, was pure of heart. On October 4th, Russell was back in the big white frame house in Winder, and all that evening, telegrams and telephone calls arrived there from his colleagues, for, apprehensive over the news, they knew, as they had known during the MacArthur crisis, who was the best senator to handle the necessary investigation. The senator who was, moreover, chairman of the Senate Committee, Armed Services, into whose jurisdiction the investigation fell. This is so vital a matter that nothing short of your own guidance will give it the necessary prestige and force, John Stennis said. Stuart Symington was particularly insistent, urging complete hearings before the full committee so that the American people can learn the truth. In such hearings, he, as former Secretary of the Air Force and a longtime critic of Eisenhower's defense policies, and as a Democratic presidential candidate planning to base his campaign on the defense issue, envisioned himself playing a substantial role. But Russell, more and more aware of his loss of energy, felt there was someone better suited for the work than himself, the senator who had done such yeoman work during that earlier time of unpreparedness. Having returned from his walk to the Pertinalis, Johnson was about to put in a call to Winder when the phone rang in his living room. It was a call from Winder, and Russell told Johnson that the investigation should be carried out not by the full Armed Services Committee, but by its Preparedness Subcommittee. Symington, he was to tell Johnson, has a lot of information and would raise a lot of hell, but it would not be in the national interest. Soon, in a time of possible peril to the Republic, the telephone calls were again going back and forth between the big frame house in Sleepy Winder and the ranch in the isolated hill country. Russell's tone was again avuncular. "You're so thorough, you've got to have the answers before you ask the questions," he told Johnson. "Maybe this time you should ask the questions first." To Stennis and Symington and any other senator who asked him to conduct the investigation, Russell said, as he was to put it, that he had more or less turned this whole matter over to Senator Johnson. Preparedness had been the issue that had, in 1950, catapulted Lyndon Johnson to Senate prominence, of course, and what he did now with that issue, and with that subcommittee, which George Reedy was to say he had kept alive during the intervening years, through the same instinct that causes people to store obsolete furniture in an attic rather than throw it in the trash, duplicated in many ways what he had done with the issue and the subcommittee in 1950. There was the same instant creation of an extremely able staff from outside the Senate world. Johnson's first choice for general counsel, in fact, was the subcommittee's earlier general counsel, Donald Cook. But Cook, now president of American Electric Power and determined never to work for Lyndon Johnson again, declined. And Johnson persuaded the man who had engineered Cook's move to American Electric, the New York attorney Edwin Weissel Sr., to accept the job in his place. And Weissel brought with him the brightest of the young lawyers at his big New York law firm, Cyrus R. Vance, who quickly caught Johnson's eye, would be boosted by him up through government ranks, and during Johnson's presidency would become Secretary of the Army, as well as Edwin Weissel, Jr., a young attorney. Scientific expertise of the same quality came with the recruitment for the subcommittee's staff of scientists from Harvard and Rice Institute. These lawyers and scientists were added to the nucleus of the subcommittee's staff, headed by Daniel McGillicuddy, that was already in place, since Johnson had kept that nucleus intact over the years. Reedy was informally seconded to the subcommittee to be again its publicity director. There were the same assurances to a president, now not Harry Truman but Dwight Eisenhower, that the subcommittee would not attempt to lay blame on the administration. After one Johnson visit to the Oval Office, Eisenhower would tell Ann Whitman that Johnson had said all the right things. "I think today he is being honest." The same eloquent assurances of nonpartisanship to Senate Republicans, particularly to Stiles Bridges, who was still the subcommittee's ranking Republican member. There would be no guilty party in this inquiry except Joe Stalin and Nikita Khrushchev, Johnson said. The material being assembled by the committee staff was so deeply disturbing that even the most hardened ward healer would forget politics if he knew the facts. He therefore pledged not to embarrass the one man who can give the orders that will produce the missiles. That man is the President of the United States. "We very much appreciate the way you are approaching this," Secretary of Defense Neil McElroy replied. "If through your efforts it is kept out of partisan politics, it will be for the good of the public, and we want to work with you." To Republicans, he held up Symington as a specter, the way he had held up Joe McCarthy to Democrats in 1950. If he did not initiate it, an inquiry, it would be done by Symington, and that would be much worse, he told John Foster Dulles. There was the same journalistic praise over the nonpartisanship. The investigation will serve a useful purpose, Times editors were told in a memo from the magazine's Washington bureau. It is not, repeat, not being conceived as a witch hunt. Johnson knows that a good investigation is the only kind that will satisfy anyone and in the end bring credit to everyone. Here, as downtown, there is a sense of urgency, of consideration of the national interest. There was the same understanding that nonpartisanship was, in this instance, the best politics, for the facts that would undoubtedly be brought out could hardly reflect other than unfavorably on the administration. As a memo to Johnson from Reedy put it, this may be one of those moments in history when good politics and statesmanship are as close to each other as a hand in a glove. There was the same emphasis on publicity, the same squeezing out of every possible drop of that mother's milk of politics. Johnson's running things hit the extreme this week, John Steele was to report to his editors. He was running the photographers, and they were for once not objecting. He'd usher them to closed committee sessions for pictures, then usher them out and turn his attention to newsmen. Speaking so fast that no one could take a word-by-word account, he would rip through a briefing on a committee session, pant that he was 10 minutes late for a luncheon speech he had to make. "The statements will be up in a minute anyway," burst out of the room to give the television interviewers time for just 3 questions, then flaring up when a fourth was asked, "I told you, just 3. There was the same cultivation of the press, the same leaking of news to the most influential newsmen, the same long background sessions with columnists, a cultivation that extended into evenings when he would invite them home to dinner, or weekends when especially favored newsmen would be invited down to Huntland's, or even to Texas, with the most favored newsmen of all, Bill White and Stuart Alsop and Roland Evans, coming to the ranch. White, the most favored newsman of them all, secured the prize invitation, a visit to the ranch for Christmas. And there was the same skill in the obtaining of publicity, the same sure touch for public relations. For the right witnesses, the nation's most renowned nuclear scientists, like Edward Teller, Vannevar Bush, and Wernher von Braun, and the nation's most bemedaled generals and admirals of the nuclear age, Curtis LeMay, Hyman Rickover, James Gavin, called in the right order, the scientists first, to elevate the hearings into the realm of space and away from inter-service battles in the Pentagon, Reedy explains. And first of all the scientists, the one whose reputation as the father of the hydrogen bomb assured maximum press interest. Teller didn't disappoint. In Reedy's words, he painted a verbal picture of a universe in which mastery of outer space meant mastery of the world. The message he sent was clear. The Soviet Union had taken the first step into the heavens, and unless we hurried to catch up, the later steps would find us under communist domination. Then came the generals to paint a disturbing picture of how an overly economy-conscious administration had allowed its emphasis on a balanced budget to interfere with the nation's security. During the Korean War, the Senate Preparedness Subcommittee had been a source of vivid, apt, headline-making phrases. One phrase that Reedy now tried to suggest to Johnson, in fact, would have repeated a key word from the subcommittee's earlier heyday. Reedy suggested that Johnson say that Sputnik presented the American people with a challenge that would require a call to action instead of a summons to a siesta. Johnson rejected the suggestion out of hand. Why would a great phrase-maker need to repeat himself? New phrases evolved in his press relations, press conferences, and letters to constituents. Some linked this moment of unpreparedness to another, one worse even than Korea. Sputnik was a disaster comparable to Pearl Harbor, Lyndon Johnson said. The space age is an even greater challenge than Pearl Harbor, he said on another. Pledging nonpartisanship, he said, there were no Republicans or Democrats in this country the day after Pearl Harbor. Some evoked, not all that subtly, the speeches of a man whose speeches he wanted to imitate. By pulling together, Americans could make the space age our finest hour, he said. To Texans, he likened Sputnik not to Pearl Harbor, but to the Alamo. Texans had lost that battle, he said, but had won the war against Mexico. History does not reward the people who win the battles, but the people who win the war. His very demeanor made newsmen feel, as they had felt in 1950, that the nation was in trouble, that there was not a moment to lose, that news of the subcommittee was big news. A memo from Rowe reminded Johnson of the necessity of creating a sense of urgency to counteract the complacency of the administration, and it would be hard to imagine a more superfluous piece of advice. Yet Johnson did not, in fact, seem to feel all that much urgency himself. News of Sputnik had come on October 4th, and Russell had in the next day or so turned over the investigation to Johnson. But Johnson did not come to Washington until October 16th, and he returned to Texas 2 days later, and except for a day he spent sightseeing in Monterey, Mexico, he stayed in Texas until, on November 2nd, the Russians launched a second, much larger satellite that carried a live dog, and was therefore named Mutnik. Only then, on November 3rd, did he return to Washington for the subcommittee's organizational meetings and a 7.5-hour briefing for himself, Russell, and Bridges at the Pentagon. He stayed in Washington for 4 days, and then went back to Texas for 12 days, returning to the Capitol on November 20th to prepare for the subcommittee's hearings, so that during the more than 6 weeks following the launching of Sputnik, he was in Washington for 6 days. But during those 6 days, and when in January he returned to the Capitol full-time, he put on quite a show. A memo from Steele told his editors, "This was the pace Johnson was traveling at as he breakfasted one day at the Pentagon with McElroy, another day at the Pentagon with Wilbur Brucker, as he whisked the Senate through its opening session. Johnson was moving through days of 7 hours of committee sessions, hours of planning future sessions with his staff, the long party conferences, innumerable confabs with fellow senators and other party officials, speeches, television films for a Texas network, innumerable telephone conversations with government officials, a mountain of mail, all with a lopping, sick, speed, but with a deadly purpose. Johnson was working this week as though the orbiting of an American Sputnik was his own responsibility and that it should have been done yesterday. His speed, intensity, and energy was contagious. An Army Brigadier General grabbed a sheaf of news releases to hurry the distribution to reporters at a Johnson committee session." Leaving Capitol Hill in the evening after filing their stories for the next day's papers, reporters would glance back at the darkened Capitol and see light still blazing in that corner office on the third floor. "There seems to be a terrible sense of urgency about all this, doesn't there?" one reporter said to another, as he snatched up his notepad and ran down the hall to cover still another Johnson press conference. Watching Lyndon Johnson hurry through the corridors, coattails flapping, journalists coined jokes about his intensity. "Light a match behind Lyndon and he'd orbit," was one. There was new proof that in 1958 as in 1950, no matter how skilled Reedy might be, Lyndon Johnson was his own best public relations man. One day in January, the Preparedness Subcommittee, which had met in open session that morning, was scheduled to meet behind closed doors to hear sensitive testimony from Major General John B. Medeiros, Commander-in-Chief of the Army Ballistic Missile Agency. During the noon break, however, while Johnson was, in John Steele's phrase, lapping up a creamed chicken dish in his ornate green and gold Senate office, the phone rang. Defense Secretary McElroy wanted to tell him that he was about to make an important announcement, that the Army was being authorized to proceed on a top-priority basis with the development of a solid-fuel missile instead of relying on liquid-fueled missiles as in the past. Johnson didn't hesitate. Without so much as a pause, he asked McElroy not to make the announcement himself, but instead to let General Medeiros make it, during his testimony before the subcommittee. The headline-making news would therefore come not from the Pentagon, but from the Johnson subcommittee, and Johnson made sure that the headlines would be big. The time was already about 2:22 p.m. The closed-door session was scheduled to begin in 8 minutes. Johnson sent aides and secretaries scurrying to the press room and to the Senate cafeteria, where some journalists ate lunch, to announce that at 2:30 sharp the subcommittee's doors would be thrown open, very briefly, for an important announcement. Reporters and photographers came running, some still chewing, and as they entered the room, Johnson, pounding his gavel for order, shouted, with the air of someone delivering a communique from a war zone, "General Medeiros has a brief announcement to make. Copies of his statement will be ready in a few minutes." Two senators, Saltonstall and Flanders, were entering the committee room at a leisurely post-prandial senatorial pace, and then, as soon as Flanders sat down, he got up again and started to leave the room. "Senator, Senator, where are you going?" Johnson asked. "Oh, I'll be back in 15 seconds," Flanders replied. "But you can't leave us. This isn't going to take 15 seconds," Johnson said curtly. Flanders sat back down, and Medeiros made his announcement. And although there had been very little time to prepare a quotable phrase, one was ready on Lyndon Johnson's lips. As soon as Medeiros had finished reading, Johnson told the general, as reporters' pens scribbled, "I hope this is not just a directive, but that it is backed up with cold hard cash. If you will convey that message to him, McElroy, maybe it will persuade him to make some more decisions." In case anyone had missed them, Johnson repeated the key words twice. "Cold hard cash," he said. "Cold hard cash." There was still television to be accommodated. This was a problem because the TV camera crews, anticipating a closed session to which their bulky cameras would not be admitted, had left them down by the caucus room while they had lunch, and had not been able to lug them downstairs in time for the announcement. Even as Medeiros was speaking, Johnson aides were telling the cameramen to set up their cameras in the corridor outside the committee room, and as soon as the general had finished, Johnson stepped around the committee table, grabbed his arm, pulled him bodily out of his chair, and propelled him into the hall. "Now, fellas, let's roll it," Johnson said, standing so close to Medeiros that it would have been difficult to show the general without showing him too. One of the cameramen, still panting from his race upstairs, managed to say that one of their number had not yet arrived. "Well, you take it and give it to him," Johnson said angrily. And when the cameramen said that was impossible, he replied, "Now listen, I told you to be ready." No one dared to mention that he had given them 8 minutes to do so, Evans and Novak said. There were other similarities between 1958 and 1950, the same tendency toward hyperbole and oversimplification, for example. Dramatic though the Sputnik launchings may have been, their military significance, their significance, in other words, for America's safety, was minimal. The launchings showed that the Russians had indeed developed rockets with more thrust than America's, but it was not thrust, but rather the rockets' accuracy and the destructive power of the nuclear warheads they carried that would count in war. And in both accuracy and explosive power, the United States was still far ahead. In addition, America's bomber fleet of huge B-52s, constantly on alert or in the air, was vastly superior to Russia's bomber fleet, and had the added advantage of access to airfields virtually on Russia's borders. A Soviet attack on the United States would, for all Nikita Khrushchev's blustering, have been suicidal. America had enough nuclear capacity and missile technology, many times more than enough, to reduce the Soviet Union's cities and factories to ruins should the USSR launch an attack. Moreover, during the Eisenhower administration, the American margin of superiority had not narrowed, but widened. Quite sure of these facts, in part because of amazingly detailed photographic evidence from U-2s, supersonic reconnaissance aircraft that overflew the USSR at heights of up to 15,000 feet, Dwight Eisenhower attempted, in the weeks after Sputnik, to reassure a jittery America. Although believing incorrectly that Russia was unaware of the U-2 flights, he shied away from revealing any facts that might have given the Russians a hint of their existence. In an October 9th news conference, in which journalists' questions, reflecting the mood of the moment, were more suspicious than at any other conference during his presidency, Eisenhower said that the satellite does not raise my apprehensions, not one iota. He would rather have one good Redstone nuclear-armed missile than a rocket that could hit the moon, he said. We have no enemies on the moon. Repeatedly during this period, the president sought to explain that we had more than enough nuclear capacity already, so that massive emergency spending to develop more bombs was unjustifiable. What is going to be done with this tremendous number of enormous weapons? He asked on one occasion. How many times could you kill the same man? He asked on another. Furthermore, he said, the greatly accelerated spending would have unfortunate effects which his critics did not seem to have considered. As Ambrose puts it, he deplored the Pearl Harbor atmosphere, the readiness to forget economics and spend whatever had to be spent to win the war. We face, the president said, not a temporary emergency but a long-term responsibility. Hasty and extraordinary effort under the impetus of sudden fear cannot provide for an adequate answer. He said he knew he could get whatever he asked for from Congress in the way of defense spending, but the suggested expenditures were at the expense of needed civilian expenditures and were unjustifiable. We must remember that we are defending a way of life. Turning America into a garrison state would mean taking the risk that all we are striving to defend could disappear. Lyndon Johnson, briefed repeatedly by the Pentagon, must have been aware of these reassuring facts, but his statements continued to be short on facts and long on Pearl Harbor atmosphere. His subcommittee's first report, filed on January 23, 1958, said, "We have reached a state of history where defense involves the total effort of a nation." Total effort meant in 1958 what it had meant in 1950. Once again, the Senate Preparedness Subcommittee called for America to place itself, immediately, on an all-out war footing. In a prepared speech Johnson delivered on October 17th, he said that the 40-hour work week will not produce intercontinental ballistic missiles, and therefore the entire nation must go on a full wartime mobilization schedule. His rhetoric escalated. America's first attempt to orbit a satellite, the Vanguard 1, failed on December 6th, when the missile exploded as it was leaving the Cape Canaveral launching pad. The news was delivered to Johnson as he was chairing a subcommittee hearing before a large crowd in the Senate caucus room. How long, O God, how long will it take us to catch up with the Russians' two satellites?" he asked. His speeches, the author Alfred Steinberg says, painted a frightening picture of the horror that would overtake the United States if it did not treat Soviet leadership in missilery as a war. "Control of space means control of the world," Johnson said. "From space, the masters of infinity would have the power to control the Earth's weather, to cause drought and flood, to change the tides and raise the levels of the sea, to divert the Gulf Stream and change temperate climates to frigid." The subcommittee hearings were to generate headlines day after day, but even Reedy was to admit that, in retrospect, some of the material should have been examined more carefully before being spread on the record in ex-party proceedings. One of the results was the public creation of a missile gap, a concept that we were hopelessly behind the Soviets in the possession of ICBMs. And in 1958, as in 1950, the Preparedness Subcommittee produced a publicity bonanza. Hearings in the Senate caucus room jammed with radio and television cameras and microphones, cover articles in national magazines. In a week of shot and shell in Washington, Lyndon Johnson went a far piece toward seizing, on behalf of the legislative branch, the leadership in reshaping U.S. defense policy, Life asserted. And there were again in 58 as in 50 indications that it was less preparedness than publicity that was the subcommittee chairman's primary concern. Eisenhower's calm assurances began to be understood, and they were bolstered by the successful launching of America's first satellite, Explorer, on January 31, 1958. And the resultant slackening of media interest in the missile crisis was mirrored by a corresponding slackening in the chairman's interest. As usual, the shift followed a Jim Rowe memo, this one typed on February 5th. "I believe you have gained all you can on space and missiles," it said. "You have received a tremendous press, increased your national stature, and gotten away scot-free without a scratch." A major recession was underway, and, Rowe wrote, "I think you should turn now to the obvious new issue, which is unemployment." Johnson turned. In the early spring, George Reedy was to say, he just plain lost interest in the space issue. The public had begun to calm down, and the Buck Rogers serials had played themselves out. He had never been comfortable with the subject matter and welcomed the rise of a new issue that he really understood, unemployment. Unfortunately, Johnson could see the missile issue only in terms of newspaper space and public attention. It did not involve poverty, education, or economic opportunity, problems which really held his attention. Therefore, as column inches devoted to outer space dwindled and as polls registered a diminution of popular interest, he virtually abandoned the entire project. Abandoned was not an overstatement. Lyndon Johnson's loss of interest in the space and missile investigation was complete. As became clear when aides approached him to ask for guidelines for the final subcommittee report. To their astonishment, Johnson didn't want a report. He would actually have preferred that the subcommittee issue nothing at all, Evans and Novak would later report. Johnson did not see a problem in this. It did not bother him to abandon a program once he had concluded that it had lost its popular appeal, Reedy was to say. Reedy, however, saw a big problem, danger that the 1958 investigation would come to resemble the 1950 investigation in another respect, and that journalists who had been around in 1950 might recognize and call attention to the similarity. Some of the staff members recognized that leaving it, the subcommittee report, in limbo would ultimately work against Johnson, he says. He had something of a reputation of exploiting issues without bringing them to a head, and to forget outer space after all the drama would have been deadly. A final report, including 17 tersely worded, extremely general recommendations. Sample: start work at once on the development of a rocket motor with 1,000,000 pounds of thrust. Was drafted by Weissel and Vance and approved by the 6 other subcommittee members, in yet another example of bipartisan unanimity. And, Reedy says, Johnson's worried assistants, who realized that his language during the hearings had been too strong to close the books with nothing accomplished, pushed him into introducing a bill to create a new Senate committee, a special committee on space and astronautics, whose chairmanship Johnson took, to draft legislation for a national space program. We'd shove the bills into Johnson's hands and get him to introduce them, and that's the way the act emerged, Reedy was to say, in a recollection confirmed by other aides. What Reedy calls the bills were actually amendments to legislation that had been drafted not by the committee but by the Eisenhower administration, which sent to Congress a bill creating a National Aeronautics and Space Agency, NASA. Identifying the bill's principal weakness, its lack of provision for a central policy-making body, Weissel, Vance, and Salas Horwitz recommended an amendment creating within NASA a small 9-member space council. Although during the ensuing legislative process, Johnson, in Robert Devine's words, let his staff do most of the work, he insisted that the recommendation be incorporated in the act. Eisenhower wanted only a purely advisory body, not one which makes decisions, but in a meeting on Sunday, July 7th, he and Johnson worked out a compromise, keeping the policy council but appointing the president as its head, and on July 29th, 1958, Eisenhower signed the NASA Act into law. Ike knew, as Devine writes, that he had outmaneuvered Johnson. Over the next 3 years, the Space Council met on only rare occasions, without Eisenhower in attendance, and during that time had relatively little influence on national space or defense policies. But Johnson, in introducing the bill, said, reading from a memo drafted by Reedy, that he wanted to be a major figure in the greatest of mankind's adventures. And Reedy's maneuvers successfully concealed from journalists his boss's lack of interest. Their reaction is summarized in Evans and Novak's judgment that the Preparedness Subcommittee's space investigation was a textbook example of what a Senate investigation ought to be. Despite such statements, in 1958 as in 1950, the actual results of a much-publicized Lyndon Johnson preparedness investigation were virtually non-existent. Johnson made it clear that he was going through the motions of introducing and supporting the bill only to quiet the insistent demands of his staff, Reedy says. The creation of a space agency was significant in its institutionalization of the drive to explore space, but its form in practice was little different from the form it would have taken had Johnson not held his preparedness investigation. It would not be until 1961, when President Kennedy put Vice President Johnson in charge of the space program, that Johnson became genuinely active in a field with which he would become prominently identified. In later years, when he was reaping the public image benefits of NASA achievements, he persuaded himself that they had taken place because of his prodding of his colleagues and his staff, Reedy would comment. The space investigation's lack of accomplishment and its other similarities to episodes in Lyndon Johnson's early Senate career was typical of the overall pattern of Lyndon Johnson's last 3 years in the Senate. The last 2 years of the congressional decade, 1959 and 1960, can only be described as dreary, Reedy was to write, and with the exception of the space investigation, that adjective can be applied to the 1958 session as well. There was, again, as in the Bricker Amendment Battle of 1954, a fight against right-wing attempts to cripple another branch of the federal government, this time not the presidency, but the Supreme Court. The South, of course, had been eager to punish the court and limit its power ever since the Brown decision that year. In 1956 and 57, in a series of civil liberties rulings, the court overturned or narrowed anti-communist or anti-subversive legislation passed by individual states and reaffirmed the supremacy of federal over state law. The Southern ranks were therefore swelled by the Jenners and Butlers and Curtises, by Northern right-wingers of both parties. In August 1958, shortly before adjournment, the conservatives had enough votes in both House and Senate to pass three anti-court bills. Having rolled through the House, the bills were reported favorably to the Senate by Jim Eastland's Judiciary Committee. As ill-drafted as they were ill-considered, they would be called a legal monstrosity, they were the kind of bills that gave the Senate a bad name. They would, for example, force interstate business to comply with 48 different and not infrequently conflicting state laws. It was too much even for Russell, who also realized that passage of such legislation would be a severe blow to Lyndon Johnson's efforts to woo liberal support for his presidential bid. Georgia's senior senator had spoken for the bills publicly, of course, but behind the closed doors of the policy committee had not disagreed with Johnson's decision to delay bringing them to the floor until August, when they could be buried in end-of-the-session confusion. Johnson had put Humphrey and Hennings in charge of counting votes, and when they assured him the bills would be defeated, he told the policy committee, "Well, I'm going to have to let them, conservatives, have their day on this stuff." When he called the Court Ripper bills up on Tuesday, August 19th, and the first two were defeated, Humphrey's count appeared correct. But when the third bill was brought up late Wednesday evening, with the Senate tired and querulous, the court's civil rights record suddenly was brought into a dialogue on the Senate floor, and in a moment all the old passions were aroused, angry exchanges broke out, positions hardened, and when the roll was called on a motion to table and thus kill the third bill, the motion lost, 39-46. A second vote lost, 40-47. Richard Russell saw what was coming. As the Senate floor erupted in shouting matches, he leaned forward and whispered to the man at the desk in front of him, "Lyndon, you'd better adjourn this place. They're going to pass this goddamn bill." Jumping to his feet, Johnson said, "Mr. President, I move that the Senate adjourn." But so infuriated were the conservatives by his action that, although adjournment was the majority leader's prerogative, several senators insisted on a roll call on his motion. As it began, Lyndon Johnson stood up at his desk. There was a clipboard in his hand, and on it a long sheet of paper. When a vote was cast against him, the majority leader wrote down the name of the senator who had done so, making sure that what he was doing was obvious. This act of less than subtle intimidation had its desired effect. At the end of the vote, there were only 18 names on the paper. Walking over to Humphrey, who was shaking his head in bewilderment, Johnson let him know that he had failed, again, at vote counting. "You boys screwed up," he said. "I don't know what you did, but you screwed up. You told me wrong." Then he said, "If you want to beat this thing, there's still a way." Starting to explain the strategy that would have to be used, he suddenly realized that there were reporters listening. "I don't know these people," he said. "Let's get out of here." He started to lead Humphrey to his office. As he was crossing the Senate reception room, he saw Anthony Lewis, the New York Times Supreme Court reporter, coming down the stairs. Grabbing Lewis's arm, Johnson brought him along, and Reedy as well, and the four men settled down for a talk, the majority leader behind the big desk, the three men facing him. Every 20 minutes or so, a secretary would come in and hand Johnson a fresh Cutty Sark and soda, which he would gulp down. They settled down, to be more precise, for a monologue. In the course of 2 hours, Humphrey may have gotten out about 3 sentences, recalls Lewis, who, familiar with Humphrey's customary garrulousness, was astonished. As for himself and Reedy, I don't think we said a word. Lewis would never forget that monologue. An acute political observer, he understood its purpose. It was, he would say, a display of his being on the right side of issues. McPherson would explain Johnson's thinking. What an opportunity to defeat a bad bill, save the court, and win the embarrassed thanks of Senate liberals. It was worth doing. But nonetheless, the monologue was awesome. Not only a step-by-step exegesis of the complicated parliamentary maneuvers that alone could stop the bill from passing, but an exposition of why it should be stopped. An exposition so passionate that from that day forward, Anthony Lewis would believe in Lyndon Johnson's commitment to liberal causes. Johnson always wanted to be seen by people like me as a defender of civil liberties, he would say decades later. On the other hand, I think he actually believed in it. At least that's my opinion. It's my opinion because of things like the passionate lecture I saw him give Hubert Humphrey that night. Lewis would remember with particular vividness one incident that occurred during the monologue while Johnson was explaining that he would need time to carry out his maneuvers, and that therefore Humphrey would have to filibuster to give him that time. And if the maneuvers failed, Johnson said, Humphrey would still have to filibuster, because if the maneuvers failed, a filibuster would be the only way to defeat the bill. Humphrey, who, of course, as Lewis knew, had been fighting filibusters all his life, was reluctant to agree to do that, and Johnson said he understood Humphrey's feelings. But then Lyndon Johnson said, Hubert, they're really going to lambaste you for filibustering because you've always been against the filibuster. But if they hit you on one cheek, Hubert, you got to turn the other cheek. And as Lyndon Johnson said that, he took one of his huge hands and slapped one of his own cheeks with the flat of that hand. Slapped it hard. And then he took his other hand and slapped his other cheek. Hard. So hard, Anthony Lewis would recall decades later. He took his hand, which was a very large hand, and he hit himself on the cheek, so hard. I thought that must have hurt. And then he took the other hand. I felt he believed in what he was saying, definitely. As it turned out, a filibuster would not be necessary. When the Senate convened the next day, Johnson put into motion the tactics he had outlined during the monologue. First, he had a motion introduced to return the bill to the Judiciary Committee, so that the vote would not be on the bill, but only on the procedural motion, and therefore, senators Johnson wanted to switch their vote could, as Mann says, truthfully claim that they had voted not to kill the bill, but only to return it to committee. Then, using pressure and persuasion, he got enough senators to switch so that the vote on the motion was a tie, 40-40. And finally, he got the 41st vote, by persuading the GOP conservative Wallace Bennett of Utah to switch. An ardent supporter of Richard Nixon, Bennett very much wanted Nixon to be president. Johnson pointed out to him that a tie vote would have to be broken by Nixon, and no matter how Nixon voted, Johnson told Bennett, the vote would hurt Nixon's chances to become president. He would have to antagonize either liberals or conservatives. The way to save Nixon from this dilemma, Johnson said, was to make sure the vote wasn't a tie. So, as startled exclamations came from the gallery, Bennett voted aye, to send the anti-court bill back to judiciary and death there. During these last 3 years, Lyndon Johnson would again, as in his early years, have to placate Herman Brown and the Texas right-wingers, which he did by steering to passage in behind-the-scenes maneuvers the harshly anti-labor Landrum-Griffin Act, and the great Senate bulls. He paid off a lot of debts to Clinton Anderson by cooperating in Anderson's efforts to defeat President Eisenhower's nomination of Louis Strauss to be Secretary of Commerce, the first defeat of a presidential nominee for a cabinet office since 1925. To try to placate liberals, he produced in each of the 3 years, 1958, 1959, and 1960, a legislative package of progressive proposals that he said should be passed. The 1958 package had one fewer proposal than the 13-point program with the heart of 1956, but was otherwise quite similar, and the fate of all three packages was similar to that of the 1956 program, too. The few proposals that were passed had been watered down to inconsequentiality. His interest in the 1960 Democratic presidential nomination made it impossible for him to avoid the civil rights issue, but his civil rights enthusiasm of 1957 had noticeably faded, possibly because, as much as he needed liberal support to obtain the nomination, Southern support was still the sine qua non, and in 1957 he had pushed Southern senators and Richard Russell as far as they would go. The net result of the 1959 and 1960 Senate civil rights battles was, at best, the smallest of steps forward, and it may even have been a step back. In 1959, as in 1953, 1955, and 1957, Johnson first cut the ground out from under a liberal attempt to revise Rule 22 by engineering a compromise which, although technically a very modest weakening of that rule, might very well have proved in practice to strengthen it. John Stennis praised Johnson's matchless leadership in obtaining the compromise. Forced into introducing a civil rights bill of his own when both the liberals and the White House introduced their bills, he devised a measure so tame that Roy Wilkins called it a sugar-coated pacifier. And then he allowed even that bill to die within the Judiciary Committee. In 1960, the Southerners staged a filibuster, the filibuster they had forsworn in 1957, against another liberal attempt to pass a civil rights bill. Lining up on the side of the South, Johnson opposed a liberal attempt to impose cloture. The vote on cloture, after 2 months of Southern speeches, was 42-4, 53 against, figures that may be the clearest indication as to whether cloture could have been imposed in 1957. Liberals had taken the 38 votes they obtained in the 1957 Rule 22 fight as a hopeful sign that they were in sight of the two-thirds vote needed to change the rule and make cloture possible. Now, 2 years later, a vote had been taken on the cloture issue itself, and not only had they not obtained the necessary two-thirds, they had not even obtained a majority. As Robert Mann was to write, gone was their argument that an outmoded cloture rule was preventing the Senate from voting. The civil rights bill that eventually passed in 1960, with the tacit acquiescence of Russell and the South, was a bill that Johnson, working with Eisenhower's new Attorney General, William P. Rogers, had weakened to the point of meaninglessness. Liberals could only be thankful that, as Joe Clark put it, Russell, the Southern Generalissimo, was a gracious victor who threw the liberals a few crumbs. When the bill passed, Clark approached Russell and said, "Dick, here is my sword. I hope you will give it back to me so that I can beat it into a plowshare for spring planting." Chapter 43, the last chapter. The Last Caucus. The story of Lyndon Johnson's campaign for his party's 1960 presidential nomination, of his failure to win the nomination, and of his decision to accept second place on the ticket instead, will be told in the next volume of The Years of Lyndon Johnson. One aspect of the aftermath of the 1960 election, however, belongs in this volume because it is part of the story of Lyndon Johnson and the Senate. On November 5, 1960, Lyndon Johnson won election for both the Vice Presidency of the United States on the Kennedy-Johnson ticket and for a third term as Senator. He had had Texas law changed to allow him to run for both offices. When he won the Vice Presidency, he made arrangements to resign from the Senate, as he was required to do under federal law, as soon as it convened on January 3, 1961. Johnson was sure he would still be a figure of power in Washington, no matter how powerless a job the vice presidency had been in the past. He would break the mold. "Power is where power goes," he told journalists. Furthermore, although he was giving up his seat in the Senate, he did not plan to give up his power there. During the weeks between November 5th and January 3rd, he devised an unprecedented plan: to continue, although he would no longer be a senator, to exercise power over the Senate's Democratic majority. Under his plan, he would do this not as majority leader, but as chairman of the Senate's Democratic caucus. The new majority leader was going to be his whip, Mike Mansfield. In the past, the leader had routinely been elected chairman of the caucus, as Johnson himself had, of course, been elected. Sometime in December, however, the vice president-elect asked a few key senators, Russell, Kerr, Smathers, and Humphrey, to have lunch with him, not on Capitol Hill, but in a private dining room at the Sheraton Carlton Hotel. Probably hoping, Hubert Humphrey was to say, to keep it a secret. And at this lunch he revealed his plan, that at the caucus he, not Mansfield, would be elected chairman, that he would remain in the post that he had held for the past 8 years. It was apparent to the men in the dining room that Johnson intended to use the chairmanship to do more than merely preside over the caucus, that in Humphrey's words he wanted to use the post to hang on to the power he had had as majority leader, as a de facto majority leader. Johnson, Humphrey was to say, had the illusion that he could be, in a sense, as vice president, the majority leader. Although the men in the room were all friends of Johnson's, doubts were immediately expressed. Humphrey, worried always about inflicting pain, said the plan would offend Mike Mansfield and other leaders. And when Johnson said he was sure Mansfield would go along, the fact that the plan would violate the constitutional separation of powers between the executive and legislative branches was raised. But, Humphrey was to say, he's not an easy man to tell that you can't do something. Johnson may have said, he was to use these arguments later, that the Constitution already assigned the vice president functions in the Senate, to preside over it and to vote in it in case of a tie. He was later to say that chairing a party caucus would be only another similar function. Whatever he said, he apparently believed he had persuaded the others to go along. He certainly persuaded Mansfield to go along, by telling him the caucus chairmanship was only a symbolic honor. He persuaded Mansfield, in fact, not only to let him be chairman, but to nominate him for the job. Johnson, Mansfield was to say, asked if I would propose that he be permitted to attend future caucuses as vice president and also to preside. In my view, this would constitute only an honorary position, and I had no objection. While he was at it, Johnson also persuaded Mansfield to allow him to retain not only the chairmanship, but another symbol of his power, the Taj Mahal. It had formerly been designated the majority leader's office. Now it would become the vice president's office. So Johnson would still be operating out of it when he was in the Capitol. Mansfield said he would be happy to use a much smaller suite, about half the size of the Taj Mahal, on the other side of the Senate chamber. And Johnson also persuaded Mansfield that he should retain Bobby Baker as secretary for the majority. When Baker received a call to come to the Taj Mahal, he found Lyndon Johnson exultant. There was a buoyancy about him that lately had been missing, Baker was to say. Johnson seemed, in fact, almost manic. Waving Baker to a chair, he paced around the room. "Bobby," he said, "I've been thinking about where I can do Jack Kennedy the most good, and it's right here on this hill, the place I know best." "Jack Kennedy," he said, "never learned how things operate around here, and all those Bostons and Harvards, with whom Jack was surrounding himself, don't know any more about Capitol Hill than an old maid does about fucking." His eyes shining with triumph, he gave Baker a piece of good news. "I'm going to keep this office," he said, waving his arm in an expansive arc to emphasize its grandeur. He gave him another piece of good news for Baker as well as for himself. "You can keep on helping me like you've always done," he said. "It's going to be just the way it was." Then, coming over to Baker and standing close to him, Lyndon Johnson lowered his voice dramatically as he gave him the best news of all. "Just between me and you and the gatepost, Bobby," he said, "I'm working it out with Mike and Hubert to attend meetings of the Senate Democratic Caucus. Maybe even preside over 'em. That way I can keep my hand in. I can help Jack Kennedy's program and be his eyes and ears. What do you think of that?" Baker knew what he thought of it. "To tell the truth, I was both astonished and horrified," he was to say. If anyone knew the United States Senate, its proud members and its proud traditions, it was Lyndon B. Johnson. Surely he knew that the prerogatives of membership were jealously guarded, that no member of the executive branch, even a Lyndon Johnson, would be welcomed in from the cold. Indeed, it seemed apparent that senators who long had chafed under LBJ's iron rule would have conniptions at the very idea of his continuing to exercise control over its affairs. Johnson certainly understood all this, Baker felt. "I originally couldn't believe that LBJ believed he could successfully carry off his plan." But as Johnson continued to expound on his new scheme, Baker realized he was serious. "I saw a disaster in the making." But when, after a while, Baker worked up the nerve to voice a few reservations, Johnson, blinded by his plans, his ego, and his past Senate successes, overrode them and just kept talking. The most he would agree to was to allow Baker to do a little pulse-taking. Taking the pulse, Baker found that his fears were justified. News had already seeped out about the proposed retention of the Taj Mahal and of Baker, raising what he called apprehensions among Senate liberals that Bobby would be in the future, as in the past, less the Democrats' agent than Johnson's. The Democratic liberals were, Evans and Novak explained, brooding that Johnson would try to run the Senate from the vice president's chair, with Mansfield, the self-effacing, introspective former professor who was uncomfortable with power, deferring to him. And although Baker kept his hints about a retention of a caucus role by Johnson carefully vague, these hints heightened senatorial fears. Having watched him, Johnson, operate for 8 years, Democratic senators were fearful of what he might do now if he got a toe in the door, Evans and Novak were to explain. An unspoken sentiment among many senators was the fear that if Johnson became de facto chairman of the conference, he would use that position as a lever to become de facto majority leader, with tentacles of power into both the steering and policy committees, newly headed but not controlled by Mansfield. Wary of Baker's closeness to Johnson, senators were, Baker was to say, reserved in their responses, but he had been taught to listen to what they weren't saying, and his findings were not comforting. Refusing to take Baker's findings seriously, Johnson put his plan into operation. When the Democratic caucus was held at 9:45 a.m. on January 3rd, he had not yet resigned as senator. He would do so after the Senate convened at noon. So he was still a senator and still majority leader, and he strode into the caucus with a broad, easy smile, the faithful Baker at his side, went up to the table that had been set up in front, sat down in the seat he had held for 8 years, and called the conference to order. Mansfield was then elected majority leader by acclamation, but Johnson did not hand him the gavel and vacate his chair. Mansfield took a chair that had been set up next to Johnson's at the table, and made a motion, the minutes report, that the vice president-elect preside over future conferences. As one of the senators in the room, Robert C. Byrd of West Virginia, was to write, "Can you imagine that? This action by the new majority leader reflected the quiet and unassuming nature of Mike Mansfield, but it was a mistake." As Evans and Novak were to write, "Mansfield was proposing that the Senate of the 87th Congress do what no other Senate had done, breach the constitutional separation of powers by making the vice president the presiding officer of all the Senate Democrats whenever they met in a formal conference." Several senators jumped to their feet to object. Johnson, as chairman, had to recognize them. Among the first were Joe Clark and Albert Gore. Looking directly at Johnson, Gore said angrily, "We might as well ask Jack Kennedy to come back up to the Senate and take his turn at presiding. I don't know of any right for a vice president to preside or even be here with senators. This caucus is not open to former senators." As Gore defied him, standing only a few feet away from him and staring him in the eye, an angry flush spread over Johnson's face. But Gore and Clark were liberals. Their opposition had been anticipated, and it could be disregarded. For 8 years, Johnson had been disregarding liberal objections with the support of the old Senate bulls. But then other hands went up, and among them were the hands of three bulls, Olin Johnston, Willis Robertson, and Clint Anderson. One after another, Johnson recognized them, expecting them to support Mansfield's motion. One after another, they attacked it. Unbelievably, to Baker, even Anderson attacked it. He was a friend of Lyndon's, Anderson said. He had supported him in the Senate, and he said all Democratic senators owed Lyndon a great debt for his leadership. But, Anderson said, the vice president was an official of the executive branch. Selection of a member of that branch to preside over a senatorial body would not only shatter the principle of separation of powers, but would also make the Senate look ridiculous. Bobby Baker sneaked another look at Johnson. The leader's face, red a moment before, had gone completely ashen. He recognized Mike Monroney, for so long the most loyal of allies. "If we support Mansfield's motion," Monroney said, "we are creating a precedent of concrete and steel. The Senate will lose its powers by having a representative of the executive branch watching our private caucuses." All of the old bulls included praise of Johnson in their remarks, Bobby Baker was to say. But there was no getting around that they were inviting him out of their Senate inner circle. It was obvious that sentiment in the room was heavily against the motion, but Mansfield spoke in favor of it. He had no intention of sharing either his responsibility or authority, he said. He intended the motion only as recognition for Johnson's achievements. and the new majority leader made it personal, threatening to resign from the post to which the senators had just elected him if they did not support his proposals. Under Mansfield's threat to resign, the caucus did uphold his motion. The vote was 46-17. But everyone in the room knew that Johnson had been rebuffed, Bobby Baker was to say. "Even though we lost, we won," Gore said, "because the size of the vote didn't reflect the true sentiment." You could feel the heavy animosity in the room, even from many who voted for Lyndon, and Lyndon does possess a long antenna. As John Goldsmith of the United Press was to report, "With Senators Noe and I alike filing out of the conference room with grim expressions and angry whispers, it was clear that it wasn't going to work." Word soon was circulating along the corridors of the Senate office building that, if necessary, there could be another vote, one that would have a different result. That would not prove necessary. Several friendly senators tried to make Johnson grasp the reality of the situation. "I was one of those who told him that it was no good, and no good for him," Hubert Humphrey was to say. "It was just building up animosities." They also saw how difficult it was for him to accept the reality. "It was too much for him to leave that center of power," Humphrey says. "He was just very reluctant to give up those reins." Realizing that the situation had to be made clear to Johnson by someone who could make him understand, and realizing that there was only one senator capable of doing that, they delegated the task to him. It fell to Richard Russell, his old friend, to bring him the obvious news that he could not hang on to the power he once had, Humphrey says. After Russell spoke to him, he did understand. When the Democratic senators caucused again the next day, Lyndon Johnson was not present. Nor was he present at the next two caucuses. He did attend one on February 27th, perhaps so that a statement from his new boss, relayed through Mansfield, would not sound like a rebuke of him. Mansfield told the caucus that he had been meeting with President Kennedy about a legislative program. He said, "The president has made suggestions, but he wanted the conference to know that the president and vice president know the line of demarcation between the legislative and executive branches of government." After that, Lyndon Johnson did not attend another caucus for almost 2 years. By the time he did appear at a Democratic conference again, at two caucuses in January 1963, his attendance was no longer a threat to anyone, since by that time Washington understood that he had lost all his power, so completely that he had become almost a figure of ridicule in the Capitol. He called these two caucuses to order and, when their business was completed, said they were adjourned. Aside from those functions, he did not, in the memory of senators who were present, participate in the caucuses at all, sitting through them saying little or nothing, staring gloomily down at the top of the table in front of him. During his early weeks as vice president, when he was presiding over the Senate while a senator was delivering a lengthy speech to an almost empty chamber, he would sometimes step down from the dais, walk over to one of the few senators on the floor, and begin to chat. The senators he approached were always courteous to him, but often they had to break off the conversation. They had other things to do. When he had had power, they had been anxious to talk to him, eager for a few moments of his time. They weren't anxious now. After a little while, he stopped coming down from the dais. Once he came into the Democratic cloakroom, which had been his domain, the cloakroom where he had stood holding fistfuls of telephone receivers, the wires stretching out from his hands, the cloakroom in which he had kicked the telephone booths, the cloakroom in whose center he had stood, Bobby Baker running up to him for whispered conferences, senators clustered around him waiting for instructions, trying to get a minute to plead with him for a favor, the cloakroom in which for 8 years he had been the center of attention. When he came in now, several senators were there, sitting in the armchairs or on the sofas. He said hello to them. They said hello to him. He stood there for several minutes, apparently waiting for someone to stand up and talk to him, or to invite him to sit down. No one did. Says one of the men who were present, "I don't think he ever came into the cloakroom again." In later years, when Lady Bird Johnson would talk about the time that her husband had been a senator, she would sometimes say, "Those were the happiest 12 years of our lives." Those years had been happy, and now they were over. The Senate had been Lyndon Johnson's home. Now he had left it. This concludes the reading of Master of the Senate by Robert A. Caro. Copyright 2002 by Robert A. Caro, Incorporated. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, Incorporated, a division of Random House, Incorporated, and was produced in 2002 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. This book was read by Grover Gardner. Books on Tape produces many new audiobook titles each month. To find out more about them, call our customer service department at the number which appears on this package, or visit us at our website, www.booksontape.com.